authors of the book The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age, Chicago artist and poster designer Ryan Dugan, live music in Studio 435 from Raven Lanay. And now here's your host, a man who is sick of this real news, Justin Coffin.
I prefer mine fake. Once I started to make the distinction, it just all went to... It just went all down the tubes. Come on, be consistent, media. I mean, did the lungfish at the Shedd Aquarium die or not die? I don't know. I got to source everything myself. I got to go around the country now. Every single time there's a news story, and check it out with my own eyes. So download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We've got an amazing show lined up. I'm so excited. First of all, I'm so excited to be with you here on Monday night. It's always great to have a show on Monday night just because, you know, you're coming off the weekend. You get a chance to reunite, to talk to the listeners, to accompany you on your, whether it be your long commute, hopefully your going to where you're at, and hopefully you're there, if that makes sense. But it's always great to be on the air here in Chicago and the region on 720 WGN. And I'm excited tonight. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling will be in studio. We will talk about the daily dose of Donald Trump today, whether it's an appeal on the travel ban or calling out the media for not covering terrorism. Donald Trump made a lot of news today, so we're going to talk with Dave and Chris. Let them argue it out. Let them hash it out. It's like two pundits enter, one pundit leaves. That's touche Monday nights. Then they both leave. They don't stay. Coming up at the big table tonight, you know, it's the 75th anniversary of the Manhattan Project, really the experiments that created nuclear fission and atomic energy and led to the atomic bombs that were used in World War II, ended World War II. We're going to talk to the authors of a new book, which is called The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age, which really gets into the life of Enrico Fermi. You know, we all know the story of the experiments in the University of Chicago underneath the football field and the squash courts, and they're creating a nuclear chain reaction, which pretty much could have blown up the entire city of Chicago. Good thing it didn't. But there's a lot more that goes into the life of Enrico Fermi and what happened after that. And these two authors from the University of Pennsylvania, go into Enrico Fermi's life, both here in Chicago and when he transfers to Los Alamos to work on the bomb. So we'll talk about that coming up at 8 o'clock. I have made a dedication at the beginning of this year to get more into science, right? And this is a good one. This is science and history. Nice little combo. So we got that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Ryan Dugan's going to join us tonight, a screen printer and poster artist. He's great. Done so many. I mean, you see the tremendous work that's done, the handcrafted work that's done for a lot of indie rock bands around the country, whether it be Bob Mould or Henry Rollins, the OCs. There's so many bands that Ryan has worked with to create unique art. And you see those art up at the Empty Bottle or up at the Metro or other places, and it's really great. And I always wondered about that art, and he's one of the preeminent artists of Chicago of his generation. So we'll talk with Ryan tonight about the dying art of screen printing and how you make sure you don't get that stuff doesn't stain your bathtub. There's pictures of stained bathtubs. If you ever rent an apartment in Chicago and you're like, why is the bathtub purple? A screen printer probably lived there beforehand. Also tonight, Studio 435, Raven Lanay returns, the high school senior who is now going out on the road with no name. They're playing at the Metro on Thursday. A tremendous, tremendous performer. When she was in here, we just talked to her over the summertime, but she is back to perform live on the show tonight. Raven Lanay, one of Chicago's best up-and-coming artists. That's tonight on Studio 435. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get this show kicked off. We got a big one. Let's start with the carryout. This is, of course, a nightly segment where I read the news to you at home. You don't have to. Here are Here are today's top stories. President Donald Trump, speaking to the U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida, said that terrorism is rampant across the globe, here and in Europe, and accused the quote-unquote dishonest media of not reporting on it. Then the White House cited several examples of attacks, mostly in the Middle East, just released by CNN. The media might be a lot of things, but to not report on a terrorist attack? Yeah. Reading the list, there are some stories of knife attacks in Egypt, and they may have missed my feed. And I can understand our Western biases against countries like Indonesia or Nigeria and Africa. But in the U.S. and Europe, it's ridiculous. And once again, it's sort of unchecked. Critics were quick to point out that it's Trump that ignores terrorism attacks, like the one on a mosque in Quebec on the day he announced his travel ban. No tweets then. But the media did cover it. And by way of lies, the media even covered the Bowling Green massacre. Right? I don't understand the point of calling out the media for not covering crime stories in Egypt. But I guess there's some method to the madness. It's fear. If they attack someone with a knife in Saudi Arabia, hey, they could take a flight, go through 3 months of vetting, and attack someone here. Right? Right. Today, Trump tweeted up a storm, but then again, so did Kim Kardashian. So they have every right to do that. But it's not public record. It's propaganda. And from here on out, I'm only going to talk about things that come out of Trump's mouth. Right? Like defending Putin by saying that we're just as bad. Okay, then. Moving on. The New York Times piece this weekend profiled the Trump White House, citing unnamed sources who say that Trump watches cable news all day, staffers can't find the light switches for the conference room, and Trump walks the halls lonely. Again, problem here, just like we talked about last week. It comes from an inside source inside the White House, one that probably doesn't share Trump's political agenda. So you know what this is? It's a hit piece. If anything, it may be time for Trump to stop ripping on the media and just plug the leaks in his own house, right? Call a plumber. Now I can understand why he wants his family and friends close to him, right? Everyone else, they're like the spy from Stratego. Just kind of hanging around when your number two or number three crosses over the marsh, whatever that is right in the middle. The confirmation train for the rest of the Trump cabinet starts up tomorrow with the confirmation vote for Betsy DeVos for education secretary. Right now, opponents are one vote short. The Dems are leading an all-night charge to try and sway one voter away, saying that DeVos is not fit for the job. I say make her do a fifth-grade Common Core test. If she passes, she's in, right? Then there were protests today by scientists over the EPA choice, another protest plan for the labor secretary, and we haven't even got to Ben Carson yet. Can't wait for that protest. It's going to be real sleepy. The Department of Justice appealed a Washington state judge's ruling to ban the travel ban. Why was this ruling in Seattle and before that in San Francisco? Let me guess, the judges in Texas and South Carolina weren't available? On a golf trip, maybe? But like everything in America, bring it to the Supreme Court. Why not, right? What should I have for lunch? Ham sandwich or a salad? Or sushi? I don't know. I'm going to take it to a California judge. Some education news here. Chicago Public Schools announced they're cutting $46 million in textbooks for the remainder of the year. This because the state reneged on a $210 million payment earlier. $46 million in textbooks? What? What happened to the hand-me-downs? Are we not wrapping books in construction paper anymore? Isn't that a thing? It was an honor to read the graffiti from last year's class clown. George Washington's glasses and beard? Hilarious. Just keep the same books. So what if everything from the 1960s is skipped over, right? The Indiana State Senate's passed a bill today to mandate students that learn cursive writing. Yep, critics responded with a frowny red-faced emoticon with smoke blowing out of its nose. I can only imagine the state senators with their walkers and their oxygen tanks demanding a return to the fancy queue. I guess you need to know cursive writing if you're going to be signing online petitions for term limits. Oh, there you go. A meteorite landed in Lake Michigan late last night. Well, it was either a meteor or an Asian carp that jumped way over that electric barrier. I don't know which one of the two, right? In weather, can I break out the capri pants yet? 50 degrees today, 50 plus tomorrow? Maybe the linen rule should be adjusted. No linen before Memorial Day? How about no linen before Groundhog's Day? In sports, football is over. Bring on baseball. It was reported that almost three-quarters of American households watched Tom Brady pull off one of the most stunning come-from-behind victories in sports history. I, like millions of non-Bostonians, was rooting for the Falcons, but I got to admit that my allegiances kind of changed as the game went on. How can you not root for that comeback? Everything had to go right, and it did. And for those on either political side that say this game is a metaphor for something, shut your tweet hole. It has no meaning, except that millionaires on both sides beat the millionaires from the other side, right? Right. The politics can begin now when former Bears Martellus Bennett said he already is going to skip the White House visit. Oh, was I the only one happy that he didn't catch the winning touchdown, right? Did everybody in Chicago go, drop it? Because we would have never heard the end of it. The Bulls continue their West Coast swing with late game in Sacto against the Kings. Hey, does Pedro Stojakovic still play for the Kings? How about Mitch Richmond? Still out there? I don't know who plays for the Kings. Jimmy Butler's day-to-day with a knee injury. Always a good injury to have if you jump for a living. And finally tonight, granddad passed away. No, not your granddad. The 86-year-old lungfish at the Shedd Aquarium. The oldest animal in any Chicago zoo. No word on which of the other fish will inherit his collection of stamps, coins, and newspapers from the Depression. They might be worth more, but you know what? They were damaged because, well, fish, they live in water. That's the carryout for February 6, 2017. Hey, we like the way you handle yourself, so we threw in some extra Parmesan cheese packets. We like you. All right, coming up, Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling. Touché! Breakdown to Daily Dose of Donald Trump. Whew, what a day. Much more to come here on 720 WGN. It's The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
All right, it's already feisty right, up in the
right,
studio.
It's all right. It's okay.
Chris Roebling and
I'm thinking about bringing in a UN force to stand between us tonight, Justin.
Bringing in Christopher Walken.
The mics are not even hot yet, and these guys are getting at each other. Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling join us every Monday night here on The Download.
It's because Touché. The Democrats are just so dedicated to obstructing progress.
Just and because the Republicans are all afraid of the Donald's tweets.
I'm not afraid of his tweets.
I don't have
any problem with his tweets. No, I mean, this is truly amazing times. You were going through the rundown. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, well, why don't we start with the appeal, the Department of Justice, which was expected, that goes through the proper channels, didn't have to do any tweets.
Big fella.
Well, let's talk about this. A judge in Washington State rules against the travel ban. The Department of Justice files a legal briefing. They appeal. Is this destined to be another one of the cases where it heads up to the Supreme Court, like everything Obama did?
It absolutely will wind up in the Supreme Court. I don't think anybody has any doubt about that. What was really interesting, though, about the George W. Bush appointed judge that issued this stay out on the West Coast was that if you watched his the interplay between him and the government's lawyers, he said, look, can you show me any evidence where anybody from any of these countries is committed a terrorist act, has been arrested, and has been just give me something. And she basically told the judge, it's none of your business, and she doesn't know anyway. And then he said, look, I need a rational basis. That's a legal concept. You need a rational basis. He said, and you've given me nothing. You've given me no facts here. I have no rational basis to conclude that the government was right to impose this ban. Hmm. So, look, I don't. Generally speaking, the judiciary defers to the president when it comes to issues of national security. So if at the end of the day they don't, it frankly will be a surprise.
What do you think of the how this has played out, Chris?
Well, I think that the immigration order is fully legal and constitutional and will be affirmed in time. It should not have been the subject of a stay because there, David is talking about the judge searching around. The judge is going well beyond any precedent relative to his inquiry because these national security issues are of their nature classified. And so he's asking the government lawyer to say something in court, which is not supposed to be said anywhere in public.
No.
And hold on a second, David. Just you had your attempt to misrepresent what's going on. Now I have to straighten it
now
out.
Now you get to misrepresent it, because that's not at all what happened in that courtroom.
So what you're talking about here is extremely settled law about the power of the president, whether it was Barack Obama, who stopped immigration on a temporary basis from Iraq right after he took office some 8 years ago, this week, last week,
actually, they stopped processing visas, but that's another story.
Because of the Bowling Green massacre,
we've stopped processing visas, too.
No, you stopped immigration.
Well, we have stopped processing visas as well, David. You might want to catch up with what's going on. So what we're talking about here is a very rationally based review of our procedures and a very targeted and a very religion neutral sort of program.
Except if you're a Christian.
Where we're saying to those governments, you have not been giving us enough information. We need more information. We need to check our own procedures to get information that we know who it is that we're letting into the United States.
I read on CNN today the concept that there may be some trouble brewing with the White House based on the past comments that Donald Trump has made before he was president. There's an article about sort of establishing some sort of anti-Muslim rhetoric or anti-cause for a travel ban as opposed to national security. Is that something that plays into play?
Yes, it will be a problem. You will see that Rudy Giuliani tape where Rudy Giuliani says he was asked by the president to find a legal way to implement his Muslim ban. You will find that in court, and it is absolutely legitimate point of inquiry. And, you know, everybody likes to pretend nothing happened before Donald Trump actually was sworn in, but the reality is because Donald Trump made that big stink about the Muslim ban and stood by it again and again and again and again.
It's absolutely not true, David. It didn't stand by it again and again and again.
He did stand by it. Where were you in the campaign?
I'm sorry. After December 2015, he never repeated the Muslim ban statement.
Yes, he did. He just didn't repeat it in those exact words.
Well, you might want to get your story straight before you go on the air and disinform the public.
Muslim ban was repeated again and again and again and again.
This is why the administration used a list that was produced by Valerie Jarrett on her own, acting individually with no authority. No, I'm kidding. This is why they used a Barack Obama list of the six countries plus the seventh, because that is absolutely crystal clear. The Obama administration did go through an exhaustive process. The Trump administration inherited that process, and they said, you know what, we're not stopping people from Morocco. We're not we're not going to Indonesia. We're not going to Malaysia. We're not going to India, which has one of the largest Muslim populations in the world. We are very finely targeted to countries cannot meet our information required to keep the United States safe.
But we will give you a preference if you're a Christian. That is what the president of the United States said on the Christian Broadcasting Network.
That is not what is said in the EO, and you
it
know
is what
that.
He
or
said.
You haven't read it.
Can I slide my body between you guys?
No.
Go right like that.
Stop.
No, it was interesting. We had Robert Pape. We had Dr. Pape on from University of Chicago. He had a study about the American face of ISIS. This was on Friday. He talked about they were doing this exhaustive study. It had nothing to do with the Trump ban,
right.
Anything.
Right.
And they were able to pinpoint
this
that
this is a lone wolf study.
Yes, absolutely. And the University of Chicago, and they said there is no case in any of the terrorism attacks that they're looking at that are coming from those countries. It's mostly homegrown. And that the Department of Justice state and the United States has to rethink the way they're approaching it.
Except the massacre at Bowling Green. I mean, the massacre at Bowling Green, those terrorists all came from those seven countries.
What we're...
Fake news.
Yeah, fake news is an issue for the Democrats more than it is for the Republicans. But I want to say what we are talking about here is, and with all due respect to Professor Pape and his colleagues and the University of Chicago and the other places where that lone wolf study emanated, from which that study emanated, I want to tell you that the president of the United States, whether it's Barack Obama, George Bush, or Donald Trump, has plenary authority with respect to immigration, with respect to national defense. And I don't care what George Bush's appointee in Seattle thinks or feels or whatever, it's not going to stand. The stay will not stand, and this EO is going to be implemented.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, we'll take a quick break. We'll do more Touche. We got to talk fake news. Touché. The media in the crosshairs once again. Tonight, we will continue with Chris and Dave here on The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what you said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché. You go
right. You go right. Time for Touché, part two. Right, right, 630 says, ask your guests, Chris, if Trump thinks Obama was such an abomination, then why is his cabinet using his intel?
Well, ah.
Obviously, the guy doesn't know about Trump, the Trump-Obama relationship, in which Trump, even just yesterday before the Super Bowl, was talking about how they've actually, despite the fact that he says, Trump was vicious towards him in the campaign, Obama was better at campaigning against me than Hillary was, he was vicious towards me, we get together, none of that matters. Yeah. We talk about what's best for America. And the fact is that there are these products of intelligence and analysis that are pretty weighty. And I think the Trump administration, you know, David won't say this because he's partisan and he's ideological. But the truth is that the Trump administration deserves a hell of a lot of credit for not making this stuff up as it goes along, but for coming into office and saying, what's right for America? How are we going to protect ourselves? And tailoring it to the...
Well, the New York
Justin, I'm sorry. I didn't bring my waiters tonight. I don't know if I can handle that much crap being leveled in the studio.
That's the level of your argument,
And by
David,
the way, he did not respond, for the record, he did not respond to 630's point, which is if Obama's was so bad...
No.
You have said for the last 8 years how horrible the Obama administration...
Newsflash,
that is 630's point.
I didn't get elected president, okay?
Yeah,
I think
thank God for the Republic.
Okay?
Although, frankly, you would have been better than Donald Trump.
Here, thank you very much, but I'm sitting here with you guys.
Low bar.
All right, let's talk about the big ticket item tonight,
man.
Fake news, but the media as well. Donald Trump today talking in Tampa, Florida. He says that the media, for whatever reason, doesn't want to cover terrorism. There's a lot of stories they don't cover. They were forced to put out a list. It was leaked to CNN. There's a list of 78 different attacks that some in here are San Bernardino and mentioned, but there are some in here that are from Algeria or from Saudi Arabia. There's Abu Dhabi, knife attacks, things like that.
Okay, here. Look, there is no question that there are some religious fanatics out there, or some of them might be secular fanatics who are operating under a cloak of religion, who have declared war on us and who wish us ill and are going to take any opportunity to harm our allies, like in Paris and in Amsterdam and all, you know, Belgium, et cetera, the Turkish airport, and us here in the United States. Okay, that's going on. Now, it's also true that you've got a better chance of being knocked over by lightning out here on Michigan Avenue than you do of being killed in a terrorist.
Why is Donald Trump really grilling in on the media? Why does he have to, in that speech, talk about the dishonest media not covering these?
Here's a good reason. There's a tremendous analysis out today on the Federalist website that picks apart 16 totally false, huge news articles since Trump was elected that had zero basis in fact. And they came out from reporters at mainstream press outlets.
It's articles, also tweets. It's
right.
It's
there
a
were
mixture
there tweets
of,
and articles,
yeah,
and
people
and
making mistakes, deletes, things
and,
like
and
that.
And
yeah.
You'd have somebody come out with somebody saying transgender kids are committing suicide now that Trump has gotten elected. Turned out there was never any basis to that. It was completely made up. And when they finally issued the retraction, nobody covered it. But it had already gone out to 20,000 retweets, meaning it was in every newsroom in America.
Okay. I have to ask Chris. Go ahead.
This is what David's people are trafficking in because they cannot deal with reform of the federal behemoth that grew under Obama.
Justin, this is a Trumpian level distraction in an attempt to avoid talking about how Donald Trump put moral equivalency between the United States and the United States leaders and Vladimir Putin. And he's done it again and again and again and again. He did it during the campaign. He did it again last night. And most Republicans I know, most real Republicans I know, are absolutely outraged that Vladimir Putin is being compared to the U.S. and his list of dozens and dozens of enemies and journalists who've been killed with polonium is somehow, according to Donald Trump, on the same moral plane. You know, it's an amazing thing.
David, have some
Donald Trump.
Will you?
Thanks. I'm good with the chocolate.
No, the polonium.
Donald Trump.
I want to make sure you got the polonium.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Donald Trump has been spinning his way to oblivion with this stuff. Today he said any negative polling on the travel ban is fake news because it's negative and that can't be true. And by the way, this Federalist junk that Chris is talking about? I read through this article. It's a long article. And this is like right-wing fantasy land.
No, it's not.
There's one tweet that set off
Chris transgender thing.
I haven't heard of half of this stuff.
Wait a second. That's not true. There's 16 reports out there. You go to the federal. You come to my Facebook page. There's a link to it. I think it's linked on Twitter as well. The Guardian is involved. The New York Times, New York Magazine, Politico, Reuters, New York, NBC,
A Guardian
AP,
writer sent out a tweet, and that is the lead on this federalist article.
Beyond examples.
These guys, they've sent out tweets, and then the stories get picked up, and the
Let me ask you this. This is something that it is outrageous, and I believe we've talked about on this program that there is erroneous reporting run amok. But at the same time, it is no different than what happened with President Obama, or even George. Partisan or bipartisan. Same with George W. Bush. I just feel like maybe the platforms have changed. But I mean, President Obama
what does that mean? So we're supposed to accept bad reporting by the journalists?
Reporting has been with us for 30 years.
This is part of the delegitimization of President Trump.
What are you talking about? Birther. That was all about delegitimizing the president.
About it.
I know you didn't,
I
but
never
the lot of articles.
But Donald Trump's entire claim to political fame came on the birther
but
thing.
But I'm just saying, birthers, he's a Muslim.
Total hypocrisy.
There was a lot that came out. It just, the platforms have changed. Social media has changed. There's been more activity.
You guys,
the quicker the platform, the more likely it is to have things that turn out to be untrue.
First of all,
The issue about the bust. In the president's office.
That's one of the 16.
It's one of the 16.
It went all
what
over.
Happened?
There were 3,000
Let's talk
news
about
worms.
That. What happened
no,
with that?
We don't have time. You wanted to talk about Russia, and I've got to denounce Russia. You wanted to talk about Russia, and you were trying to filibuster me from having any say on Russia, which I know
Pot,
a lot
about. Meat kettle.
Okay? Putin is a thug. 90% of the folks who run countries around the world where there aren't democratic elections, I got news for you, are thugs, okay? You go to China, those guys are
thugs. So you're normalizing Putin with other thugs?
No, I'm not. No, I'm saying that he is a thug, and there are a lot more like him out there. And Trump was wrong, and he has been wrong, and it's getting to be, I agree with David, it's getting to be way past time for him to get this wrong. And I've got my solution.
Which you didn't get it right.
No. Yeah, he is not supposed to be getting it wrong anymore. It's time for him to start getting it right.
What's the solution?
The solution is guys like Flynn and Mattis.
Flynn,
generals,
who was paid by the Russians, who was a paid consultant to Russian Times.
Keep your shirt on, would you? And have some more polonium.
Shh.
Anyway, those guys have got to sit down with Trump and say, this does not cut it anymore. You cannot do this. And he has got to get some statecraft 101 in.
Yeah, but the problem is everybody's got to ask why. Why does Donald Trump attack the Australians and the Canadians and the Mexicans and all these allies of ours? But the one guy he refuses to say a negative word on is Donald Trump or is Vladimir Putin. And 19% focus on the 19% of the Russian oil company that was sold off.
Oh, my God. Talk Chris about Roebling. Fantasy
All
land
right, here
left
we go.
Wing stock.
It was.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Touche every Monday night.
I think it's a conspiracy, I tell you.
You guys are great tonight. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know what? I wanted to start this segment with a quick reading. This is of an Edward R. Murrow report on the day of the famed scientist Enrico Fermi's death. It goes, "The story of the lighting of the first atomic furnace will be told as long as stories can be listened to, for it was certainly one of the most dramatic moments in the unfolding of human knowledge." Number one, that's how you write a newscast. And second, it's the story of the birth of the atomic age, and it's definitely one that resonates in this town. As many know of the experiments under the bleachers at Stagg Field on the University of Chicago campus, which led to nuclear energy and, of course, the atomic bomb. But it's surprising to note that there really hasn't been a worthy biography of one of the great scientific minds behind that experiment and the Manhattan Project, Enrico Fermi. That all changes with the new book, The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. It's written by the husband and wife team of Gino Segre and Bettino Herlin, both who have taught at the University of Pennsylvania. Segre also is a physics professor at the University of Pennsylvania. They also have connections to this great story. Segre is the nephew of Emilio Segre, Fermi's first student in Rome. And Herlin grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, the town where scientists assembled the first atomic bomb. both in studio tonight, my guests at the big table. Thanks for being here.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
Delighted to be in Chicago.
It's going to be pretty
such
amazing.
A great city.
What was it about? I mean, obviously, you know, your connections to this story, and this story is a very prominent story for Chicagoans. But talk about the idea to write this biography.
For me, there are several reasons. One is I'm a physicist. Two, I grew up part of the time in the United States and part of the time in my teens in Italy. And hey, Fermi was the greatest Italian scientist since Galileo. He was a hero when I grew up. And so, years later, I've written some books. I know physics. I know Italy, and I know the United States.
That's it.
Let's do it, you know.
You know, writing the story, there's been a lot of books that have been written on the topic of the Manhattan Project and the birth of the atomic bomb. A lot of other scientists have written books, even Enrico Fermi's wife, you know, has written works. So when you're collecting this material, it is this great living historical document.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that attracted me to writing the book was not only that Gina was doing so, but also that it was an opportunity for us to collaborate. But he was just such a remarkable person and physicist. He changed our world in so many important ways. So he also was an immigrant and came to Chicago as an immigrant. My parents had come from Germany fleeing fascism, Nazism in this case. And he, of course, had fled Italy because Laura, his wife, was Jewish. My mother was Jewish. Gino's family had fled Italy because his father was Jewish. So we had this commonality of all having come to the United States and found here a wonderful life of freedom. And, of course, Fermi excelled in doing that.
It's amazing, too, because for him to be someone who had come from Italy to play such a huge role in American science, but also, you know, the effort on the war. I mean, what he did, as Edward Murrow said, changed the world forever. Talk about that. The one word or the phrase that's used commonly in this book is this idea of enemy alien. Listening to that, I mean, I kind of get it when I'm reading it and putting it together, but that's how Enrico Fermi was explained.
Well, he was at first just an immigrant, but then when the United States entered the war, then he's classified as an enemy alien because he didn't get to be, he hadn't become a United States citizen. So even when this project started, the FBI and the War Office said, I don't think it's such a good idea that you involve this man because how can we trust him? He's an enemy alien. And fortunately, the powers that be on the Manhattan Project said, hey, we really need this guy.
You know? Yeah.
He's the man. He's the physicist we need. And they overruled the classification.
And it wasn't just, you know, working on projects. As enemy alien, I mean, it came down to whether or not people would rent apartments to him. I mean, in his family. There was a lot going against Italians and Germans in this country at that time.
I mean, just as a point, I think when they first came to Chicago, they rented, this is in 42. Initially, they came to New York, but when they came to Chicago, they rented a place. And I think the guy rented them had to disconnect his radio because he didn't want them to have, you know, that kind of stuff. There were restrictions on what enemy aliens could have.
But what is most amazing to me is here this man comes as an immigrant, is first regarded as a security risk by our military, then is labeled an enemy alien, but ends up being a key person in the most secret government project that had ever occurred, the Manhattan Project. He's assigned a bodyguard, follows him everywhere. He gets an alias name, Henry Farmer. So here he is working on the world's most incredibly secret project, and yet his background was that of not to be trusted and an enemy alien.
I mean, it was so secret that when Roosevelt died in 1945, the Secretary of War pulled Truman aside and said, President Truman now, you've been president for a few hours, but there's something we have to tell you about.
Right. He didn't even know. And it's
unbelievable.
And those are part of the elements of this story that you know, a lot of Chicagoans who have paid attention to this story, the Manhattan Project, and what happened at the University of Chicago know these things. What's interesting about the book is there's a lot about Enrico Fermi's disposition, who he was, his private life. And he is he's lauded for his precision. I would also say that there's something about his temperament that stands out, and the way that he is not that excitable. He's not so, I mean, it, almost like his even temperament is something that, that helps him in these experiments that, that quite possibly could be life and death.
Yeah, I think we can go back to his childhood a bit on that, and I don't want to pretend I'm a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but when he was just born, he was literally farmed out to a family who was living in the countryside. He was the third of three children that his mother had 1 year in succession, and it was too much for her, so he was, and was not unusual at that time, he was brought to the country to be brought up by that farm family and didn't move back into Rome with his family. He had two siblings, two older siblings, until he was 2½. He burst into tears in this new environment, which seems like a very healthy response, and his mother said, "We won't tolerate that. We won't have naughty children who cry." And I sort of trace that moment to how he was, didn't express, he really suppressed his emotions. He was totally unflappable. He was always Fermi. He was counting. He found refuge, I think, in scientific fact. And that was how he was throughout his life. His daughter, many years later, commented that it's not that he didn't have emotions, but that he didn't know how to express them.
It's a fascinating story, and we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and talk. I really want to talk about all of the work in the book about the experiment in Chicago, the one that the famed experiment underneath the University of Chicago football field.
Great.
The Pope of Physics is the new book, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age, the authors of Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin. When we take a break, we'll come back, and we'll continue here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests tonight at the big table are the authors of The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi, and The Birth of the Atomic Age. The authors are Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin, a husband and wife couple. Both have taught at the University of Pennsylvania. Gino, you continue as a physics professor there. And you guys both, I mean, we're going to get to your connection as well, Bettina, just the growing up in Los Alamos, which plays a huge role in
right.
this story.
Right.
Enrico Fermi, one of the things that he brought when he came to Chicago for the big experiment, what he brought was a Nobel Prize, of course, but he also brought this precision. What's amazing is the fact that a lot of scientists were trying to figure out this technology, or not, I don't know if technology is the right word, but this science. And he was almost always right with his calculations. I mean, this was something that was unheard of.
That's right. He was... People joke. That's why he was called the Pope. He was infallible. He was always right. And in planning this experiment, you know, it's a big experiment. They had almost, I won't go into the details of it, but it's a big thing they had to build up. It's almost 1,000,000 pounds of graphite and 200,000 pounds of uranium. And they had to put it all together. They had to pile it. They had 45,000 20-pound bricks of graphite. And the idea was to get this nuclear chain reaction. And he said, okay, we're going to build it. This is the way it's going to be. I planned it. It'll work. People even said, I mean, just to give you a story about that, suppose it doesn't work. It'll work. Don't worry. And the head of the project then said, you know, maybe I have to go ask the president of the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
Because there's a little risk that maybe we're going to blow up the university and maybe destroy
Hyde Park
Chicago.
In Chicago, right.
And he says, don't worry. I've got it. I've got it under control.
I got my calculations right.
Said, okay, Fermi says it's going to work. It's going to work.
Because at this time, there was no real sort of understanding of what could happen. I mean, you could do a nuclear chain reaction, and all the safeguards could fail. And it could just keep getting built. And you could essentially have an imploded atomic disaster in Hyde Park on the low, essentially. Like, it's a secretive project.
No, you couldn't, because Fermi said it wouldn't happen.
Exactly.
And there were 50 people in the room observing this when it happened on December 2nd, 1942. And those 50 people must have had a lot of faith in Fermi when you think about it. And somebody said, well, what if it doesn't work, Enrico? And he said, well, then you have to run like rabbits for the hills.
I'm interested in how it all came to be, because one of the things that is surprising is that there were some companies and other scientists that were being relied on. I forgot the name of the company. They were going to do it in the Argonne Forest. And it wasn't precise enough, where Enrico Fermi's and his team were like, you know, we'll do it ourselves.
Well, Argonne Forest was originally was where it was going to build because they said we better build it outside of Chicago just in case. Then they had some labor problems, and so Fermi said, we can't wait. This is really important. Look, he says, I'll build it in this big squash court under Stagg Field. And they said, well, you really want to build it in the heart of Chicago? And he says, yes. You know, I've got my team there. We can assemble it in 2 weeks.
And they worked, these scientists worked day and night. I mean, they had
And they were
shifts.
Covered in what, graphite?
Graphite,
like, just sort of like
because
charcoal,
first they
like,
were making the bricks. But they had help, too, and this was an interesting part of the story. They had help from young, very strong boys that they recruited for jobs to help them from the back of the yards of the Chicago neighborhood that is near the slaughterhouses, et cetera. And this was then a place where many immigrants landed. These were primarily Slavic immigrants from Poland. And these kids really pitched in. They were strong, and they helped build this very big, what was a precursor to a nuclear reactor that was 25 feet high, was it?
Yeah.
It was huge.
It filled the squash court. I mean, you had 45,000 20-pound bricks to put together to fit. This was not a Lego set.
I also say it's very relative in the sense that once the experiment worked and they were able to say, okay, this worked exactly how – there was a lunch break involved. That's my favorite part of the story. They took a lunch break in the middle of it.
Calm.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
in the middle of the
lunch.
We just take a break. Everyone take a break. But at the end of the day, this was a military experiment. This was the War Department, and the idea was to see if a nuclear reactor, a reaction, as we talked about, that Fermi was experimenting with, if it could happen, and at the end of the day, if it could be weaponized. How familiar and how aware were the scientists working on that project that this was going to be the building blocks for something explosive and life-changing?
They were very aware of that. That was their motivation. They knew that, you know, a nuclear reactor would be useful once the war was over. There would be nuclear medicine. There would be nuclear energy. But at that point, this was all focused on developing the material that would be needed for a bomb.
Another part of it, too, you mentioned the idea that Enrico Fermi said, this can't wait, because there was a race. Essentially, the scientists were smart enough to know that there was a group of scientists in Germany that were working to the same effort. They were also trying to create an atomic reaction in some form that could be weaponized to be used on the Allies.
Yeah, and I think that was a lot of the Manhattan Project. And this was, of course, part of the Manhattan Project. It was before the three big communities were built, before Los Alamos and Hanford and Oak Ridge were built. But it was very key to those communities being built because people knew that they could control a chain reaction. And one of the things that happened at that squash court underneath a defunct football field, when I told this story, by the way, to a friend of mine, she was most amazed by the fact that University of Chicago ever had a football team. But there they were, you know, unheated in underneath the football field. And after their successful experiment, there wasn't great jubilation, yet they had really uncovered this
incredible thing
to change the world, because they knew the implications. They knew the implications of it, and that was very sobering.
And you mentioned the three spots, and Los Alamos being one, that, you know, that this was supersized, if you will. I mean, now that they could control a nuclear reaction, the military and the government, they had to create big enough space for them to actually create the materials that could be used for an atomic bomb.
Yeah, it was a unique partnership, though, of academia, government, and industry, too. Industry was part of those three communities that made up the core of the Manhattan Project.
At this point,
there were 100,000 people by the end working on that project.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, at this point, it starts to get really...
This is a big project. I mean, I think, you know, that whole... The success was due to not only having great scientists like Fermi and Oppenheimer and so on, but also to a kind of American can-do, you know, feeling Whatever it takes, we'll do it.
Let's take a break so we can update on tonight's news. But then I want to talk about the bombs that were created from the Manhattan Project and the reaction and the ethical reaction from the world, not just from the scientific community, but from the world, and what the scientists like Enrico Fermi had accomplished as part of the Manhattan Project. The book is called The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. The authors are Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll have some more. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. That's my guest at the big table tonight, the co-authors of The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age, Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin. I love that this story, and we started the conversation tonight talking about how important it was to Chicago, but it left Chicago. And it left Chicago and it went to Los Alamos, which is the connection for you, Bettina,
right.
because you
right.
grew up in Los Alamos,
right.
New Mexico.
Right.
And Enrico Fermi, he followed in the way that he was busy, had other things going on, but at a certain point he joined the effort in Los Alamos.
I mean, he became a citizen in 1944. Anyway, he became before he went to Los Alamos, and he loved this country. He really loved this country. And I think he was interested in science. Science was his God. Science was his religion. Physics, pure and simple, that's what he loved.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like politics. And he knew that he would have to get involved to some degree in politics in terms of going to Los Alamos, in terms of the kinds of decisions that had to be made for the future. But when he was asked by the government, he went. To Los Alamos.
There seemed to be a little bit of a responsibility. He felt as being someone who was new to the country, an immigrant, and he when the government asked for him to do something, he complied.
I think that's right. I mean, the other part of this, there's always the underbelly of the whale, and the underbelly was that he had become a member of the Fascist Party in 1922.
In 1929, he became a member.
29, sorry. Bad with numbers.
You're the numbers guy, right?
He's the numbers guy.
She's the words person. I'm the number guy.
Yeah. You got to have a numbers guy, right?
29, he became a member of the Fascist Party.
So that complicated things.
And it complicated things. And when he came to this country, one of the reasons that the military did not want him involved, they said, well, he was a fascist. On the other hand, when he came to this country, he landed on January 2nd, 1939. I got that date right. Anyway, he landed in 39. And 2 months after that, there was a group of physicists, eminent physicists, who said, we have to warn Washington about the Germans getting to the bomb. We really have to do that.
Right.
And who should do that? And they looked around, and Fermi, of course, had just won the Nobel Prize. So this poor guy, he's in the country 2 months, and he's sent to Washington to break the news to our government that they really need to get going because Germany could get to the bomb before the United States. If he didn't get going, he goes to meet with some of the top brass and is announced by an administrative assistant. He can hear this announcement to an admiral down there and in Washington, and the military assistant says, sir, there's a WAP outside, which was the slang term, of course, against Italians, a very negative term. So he heard that. He heard that, but he is was still able to forgive and forget and move on.
There's something about that race, that arms race that we kind of touched on in the first half, about, you know, the scientists racing against each other. And in that race, while they're at Los Alamos and they're getting ready and they feel like they're months away, they're close to having this bomb, Germany surrenders. Hitler commits suicide. The war in Europe is over. And a lot of the scientists at that time feel a little bit like, well, the race is over in the sense that we did this for a weapons race for Germany and it's over. But the U.S. military is like, we still have a war in Japan.
We still have a war in Japan. We still need to save American lives. But there was certainly discussion at that point within the laboratory at Los Alamos and other labs as well about what is the future of the gadget. They called it the gadget. That was kind of the cover name for it. on the civilization
right.
for the
because there was something because of what was happening with the Holocaust, what was happening, the just terrible crimes against humanity that Adolf Hitler and the Germans, that there seemed to be a rally around that. When it ended and it just became a pure war, and I mean that's terrible as well, there was a little bit of complication from the scientists saying this is not something we signed up for.
Well, and there was controversy within the scientific community about what to do. They had done the test at Trinity in the New Mexico desert. They knew the bomb worked. They knew that in July. And there was controversy about what should we do now with this bomb. And there was a group at the University of Chicago led by James Frank mm-hmm. that said, we need to have a demonstration. We need to have some remote island, and we can invite the Japanese and other countries, and they will
like
be
a test to show the feats of strength.
Yes, a test, a demonstration,
right.
And they will be so awed by this bomb and terrified by it that it will end all wars. And then there was another group that said, look, we've put all this effort in. In the meantime, American lives are being lost, and we have to use this. We spent a lot of money on it, a lot of, you know, how can we face our congressmen?
And there's no guarantee that the war in Japan is going to end yeah. quickly.
There was talk about an invasion into Japan. There's a lot of risk, yeah.
yeah.
Where does Enrico Fermi, you said he wasn't political, and in the book you talk about this. I mean, where does he land on the issues preventative? I mean, it seemed to me that he just put his head into the,
well,
I guess, the physics books,
if
you will.
That the government, the United States government, formed something called an interim committee to try and decide how to use the bomb. And they said, we need a subcommittee of leading scientists to help us make this decision. And that committee had four members on it. Oppenheimer, Arthur Compton, who was in Chicago Nobel
right.
Prize winner,
right.
Ernest Lawrence, Berkeley Nobel Prize winner, and Enrico Fermi. So three Americans
wow.
and a foreigner. And they were supposed to make a recommendation. Very tricky. And at the end, they said,
no acceptable alternative in terms of they felt that, much like Pearl Harbor had been a surprise to us, that you would have to unannounced drop a bomb on a civilian population. And the firebombings of Tokyo
Dresden, yeah.
and of Dresden had killed 100,000 people. They knew that this would be about the same number of people, although it would be a very different method of destruction.
They tried to then at the end say, okay, this is our recommendation, but we're scientists, and this isn't a scientific question.
Yeah.
And for the rest, as politicians and so on, we don't know any more than anybody else. But you've asked us for our opinion. No acceptable alternative.
Okay, so Truman decides to go ahead with it. We all know the bombs dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right.
Talk about the reaction, because Truman went and publicly talked about the Manhattan Project, publicly talked about the heroes that were these scientists. The scientists with, I don't want to make it so, use such hyperbole, but the blood on the hands concept. How did they react, Enrico Fermi included, to the fact that so many innocent lives were lost in this atomic bomb attack?
There were a lot of different reactions. There are some scientists were horrified. Some scientists said, we now have to figure out how to convert this into peaceful uses of atomic energy. And other scientists did not speak out. And Fermi was among the latter. He just did not get active politically. The Los Alamos scientists formed a group called Association for Los
yeah.
Alamos Scientists. The acronym for that is ALAS. And they were looking into what are peaceful uses, how can there be international cooperation. And Fermi did not join that group. He said, I'm not joining that group. We looked very hard, including in the archives here at the University of Chicago, which were wonderful, to see whether there was any sort of admission, any sort of guilt, any sort of hesitation. And it was really hard to find that. We found a statement that was from 1952 that he gave when he gave a speech at the University of Rochester mm-hmm. saying that he hoped that mankind would make good use of the powers he acquires over nature.
And that's
it. About the closest he came to making his sister.
Because we're not talking
in Italy
about
said
centuries
you will
ago,
be judged
yeah.
by God.
There were letters from the family that were harsh to him.
Yeah.
There were reading in the book, I mean, there was a poll at the time, Americans saying 85% of Americans said this is what had to be done. As time has gone on, history is judged. The number, if you ask today or whenever it was just recent, it's 56%, 55%. Right. So history is judging this in a way that, that you're seeing more and more people questioning whether or not this was the right move.
There was also a group like Edward Teller and Ernest Lawrence who were saying, hey, we've got to build bigger and bigger bombs. The Russians are dangerous. This is it. We need another Manhattan Project.
For the H-bomb.
And Fermi was in the middle. You know, Fermi said, I want to work on physics. That's what I signed up for in my life. I don't want to build bombs. I want to work on physics.
We're talking about the life of Enrico Fermi here on The Download with the book, The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, and we'll finish up the conversation. You know, the one thing we haven't talked about is what happened post. I mean, he came back to Chicago, and we'll talk about his contributions to physics and to the city of Chicago after the war and the atomic bomb. A little bit more with The Pope of Physics here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio on the big table tonight, the Pope of Physics, new book, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age, biography about, I mean, scientist is a, I guess that's what you call him, a scientist, but Pope is good too. I think that works. Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin are the authors, the co-authors of the book. You know, after the bomb, he did come back. The University of Chicago wooed him back here to Hyde Park to teach. He led up a physics department that was structured around him that is notorious when it comes to the science community.
Absolutely. He was at that point, in right after World War II, he was probably the most prominent, the leading physicist in the world. And so young people, they wanted to come to Chicago. They came from all over the world to work with him. And Chicago was a mecca for physics. Fermi tragically died of stomach cancer in 1954. But from 1946 to 1954, that was a golden age of Chicago physics.
It's tremendous to think about, too, because his impact on the science, his students. Has there been anyone, when it comes to physics, that comes anywhere close to the impact that Enrico Fermi has had on the science?
I think so. He's also the only 20th century physicist who was at the very top of the profession, both as a theorist and an experimentalist. And so he knew it all. He worked in every part. And the one failing he had is he suffered from insomnia. So he'd get up at 4 a.m, work for a few hours, and then he'd come in to the university and say, okay, I've done my work. I'm available. Who wants to talk to me?
He's big with lunches. I forgot the instance, but he lured someone out of it into administrative duties with the promise that he could have lunches with him.
And people would do that. That was Robert Wilson, who was the first director of Fermi Lab.
There
as
he
a
goes.
Matter of fact.
You know, as you think about his impact and his legacy, you know, it's not just him. I mean, a lot of the book is about his family and notably his wife, Laura. She went on as well to be an activist who lived into the late 70s, I believe.
That's right. And Laura, she's sort of the unsung hero and of this book, I think. I hope we sing enough to her. But she came into her own, interestingly enough, almost simultaneous with his death. She had just completed a book called Adams in the Family, which is a delightful book. He had seen that book. He had lived long enough to see it on the bestseller list of the New York Times. So that was great. And she, in 1955, went to Geneva, and she was a historian for the first meeting that was held on international cooperation in regard to atomic energy. And I think was converted by that experience. She became somewhat of a peacenik. You know, unlike him who didn't express himself about that and stayed inside himself, she became an activist. And not only in terms of that, but also she led an effort in Hyde Park for clean air to get the university to stop using coal to heat with. And ultimately that became a law.
Now, she was a fixture
Chicago.
Here in Chicago, yeah.
Yeah, it was a big issue. And then a gun control advocate. So she was way ahead of her time. She was a pioneer.
The other part of this book, I mean, you talk about Enrico Fermi and his contributions to science and into the world as we know it now with nuclear energy and nuclear reactions, things of that nature. But you dedicate the book to immigrants then and now. Talk about why you do that. Why? What this story is as much about science as it is about immigrants and immigration.
I'm delighted that you started with that Murrow quote, Edward R. Murrow, talking about Fermi's death. But he went on, and his comment I'm able to read from the book here. It was the good fortune of this country that Dr. Fermi found asylum in 1938. Under the present immigration laws, and Murrow is talking, he's talking about this in 1954. He might not be admissible. His exclusion would be shared by other immigrant founding fathers of the atomic age. And that's just very important, I think, for us to remember, particularly during these times, that this nation is a nation of immigrants. Fermi was a all-star in terms of an immigrant, but many of the people working in the Los Alamos Project had, in fact, fled oppressive regimes, either in Italy, Hungary, Germany. And they were immigrants, and look what they did for this
country.
And
on a personal level, both our sets of parents came over in that period, 1938-39, before World War II. They were immigrants, so we wouldn't be here.
Let me end on a personal note for you, Bettina. I mean, you grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, which is famed for its role in the Manhattan Project.
Growing the Atomic City, yes.
The Atomic City. Growing up in there and being someone who could then turn around and write this book about Enrico Fermi. What's that mean to you?
Well, that was one of the things that attracted me to writing it. It was the Atomic City. My family actually didn't reach Los Alamos until after the war. But it was an amazing environment. It's here in the beautiful part of New Mexico. And yet here a weapon of mass destruction was put together. So the contradictions of that town, of that time.
Is that, can you feel it there? I mean, is that something that you that can, growing up in Los Alamos,
oh, yeah.
Do you feel
yeah, because
the,
you're,
that
you're
history?
Sitting, you know, you're sitting at your desk in high school, and all of a sudden they're doing little test bombs and things all over, and your desk starts shaking. And yes, you are very aware it was a gated city. The ultimate gated community, as I said. Yes, you certainly feel it. And for those women who came to Los Alamos, they must have really felt it, not being able to talk to their husbands about what they were doing.
Yeah, it was secrecy,
mainly,
right.
Yeah, it was mainly.
Gino,
men.
For you, your uncle, Emilio Segre, Enrico Fermi's first student in Rome.
Fermi had just been hired at age 26 as a professor. There were no physics students, so they went over to the engineering school and said, anybody want to switch to physics? We just hired a smart guy. And he said, yes, yes.
It's a fascinating book, the new book, The Pope of Physics, Enrico Fermi and the Birth of the Atomic Age. Gino Segre and Bettina Herlin are the authors. I can't thank you enough for coming in and spending some time to talk about this. This is a big story for Chicago, and we appreciate you telling it.
Thank you. Love being in Chicago.
Chicago should be proud of it. Thanks very much. This was great to be here.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Ryan Dugan coming up here, the man behind the screen printing. He's a screen printer and he's a poster artist. Henry Rollins, Bob Mould, other artists of that ilk. He also put out his own book called Dare to be Stupid, which is a collection of his work published back in 2015. Talk with him coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, Raven Lene live in studio 435. So excited to have her. She's tremendous, going out on tour with No Name. I saw No Name was the woman who guested on the Chance the Rapper on Saturday Night Live a couple weeks ago. She's great. They're going out on tour together. They got two shows at Metro this week, Wednesday and Thursday. But before that, she's here to perform live in studio. How great is that? Some news we missed tonight, and didn't really miss it. I don't want to say I missed it because I saw it, but the eviction of the double door in Wicker Park is one that I've just sort of filled up my Facebook feed tonight. It's a strange story. I mean, it's one of those, if you're not familiar, the double door is a longtime sort of alt-rock club in Wicker Park, right at the corner, at Six Corners there. You know, as seen everyone from the sort of bands of our time to the Rolling Stones doing quick, you know, jump-ins before they go to Soldier Field, things like that. It's been having a long time fight with his landlord. The landlord essentially wants to kick him out. They've been able to get injunctions and move things around, but the injunction essentially was expired, I guess is the right word, because they didn't pay. So Double Door all along was kind of like, we're out. And they didn't pay it, so they went back to the judge, and the judge was like, you gone. And today they put I'm sure, the really, really, really delicate and elegant stickers on the club doors. That's been a while. I mean, we kind of made that joke on the carryout not too long ago about, you know, man, I can't believe it. I haven't really been there since 2014. Like, the idea that, you know, Double Door is one of those places that I've always enjoyed the experiences I've had there, but I don't go there regularly.
Yeah, it's been a number of years since I've been there.
I was surprised to see that it was just 23 years in business. And there's talk of them moving to a different location, possibly in Logan Square.
Yeah.
But in 23 years, every time I think of Double Door, I'm like, what, man, that brand new club is doing good things over there.
We're in that area quite a bit because we like getting tacos at, you know, Big Star and whatnot, and Doves.
You're a hipster. You're in Wicker Park. Oh, yeah. You're chilling in Wicker Park.
And Johnny Flew Fog or whatever that is. Get some shoes.
Maybe get a hat from the hat place. The hat place.
And I always look at the Double Door and I'm like, boy, I haven't been there in probably 10 years.
Yeah. I've done a...
And then I say, like, I don't know any of those bands on the marquee.
I don't have... I've performed at the Double Door a couple times with Schadenfreude and with other shows that we put together, Rent Party. I did a show there. And I remember it always was fun because they had a backstage that was... Not necessarily. It was back behind the stage, and it was almost set up like Metro, where you go down the stairs and you had like a room you could just chill in,
mm-hmm.
like a really skanky couch that you could just fall into. That's what I remember the most about those experiences.
I was shocked to learn that their rent is like $24,000 or $26,000 a month.
What? And I'm shocked to learn that Joe Shanahan still has interest in that club. I didn't know that Joe Shanahan, a long time owner of the Metro, we had him on the show.
Yeah, great.
Guy. Yeah, he's the one that's sort of being quoted in that article. So Double Door no more in Wicker Park. Well, I mean, it's funny because I saw on Facebook so many people saying that the shows that they saw.
Yeah.
And I was thinking in my head, I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen so many shows. I'm like, nah, not really. The shows I remember is Liquid Soul. Liquid Soul played there, I believe, on Sunday nights after they left the Blue Note across the way, or the Note, or whatever. I think they were there. Or maybe it was Elbow Room, right, the Double Door, but they played at Double Door for years. And then I feel like every roommate I ever had played bass that finally made it to Double Door. You know what I mean? And you go on a Wednesday night and check it out with like 30 other people, and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, I used to live not too far from there, so I used to go there quite a bit. And... Yeah, I've seen tons of good shows there. I mean, you know, like Fountains of Wayne when they were a thing, and Mercury Rev, I remember. A lot of good shows. It's sad to see it go, you know, and we had the Handsome Family on Friday, and they were talking about how, like, the whole that neighborhood has changed. And I saw that somebody tweeted an article from The Reader from, like, 1988.
That was, like, the beginning of it?
That was the beginning of, like, gentrification in...
There goes the neighborhood. Double Door's moving in. That's hilarious. You wonder what they're going to do, because that's a big building. You wonder if they gut it and turn it into, you know, I don't even know what's the hot store these days.
Yeah, I don't.
I've already lost. Like, if I said Abercrombie and Fitch, be like, that's so yesterday. You need a hot store now.
Urban Outfitters, is that a hot store?
Seems like a hot store, but then again,
Madewell.
Yeah, there we go.
Top Shop.
Because they just closed up the. What was the T-shirt company there that they had for? What am I thinking of? You know what I'm thinking of. They just announced that they're closing the stores everywhere. American Apparel.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that was in Wicker Park as well. Yeah, so I mean, a far cry from the days of Wicker Park. I feel like we should do a history show on all, because when we had Veruca Salton here. Remember they were talking about doing recordings and rehearsing above Penny's?
Mm-hmm.
Penny's is gone now. Penny's is something else. It's Bill Kim's place.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And I think about all... I mean, it's amazing to me when I go through there, because I lived right around the corner there for years. And I remember, like, walking down to that area, and even when I lived there in 2003, 2002, I'm like, this place has changed. The one guy, and I can't remember the name of the place, and anyone who, I think it was Mad Bar. Remember Mad Bar?
Yeah, down Damon a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The guy who owned Mad Bar was a friend of mine, and I had met him at Columbia College back in the mid-90s. He's like, I own a bar. And I'm like, well, we'll come by. I'm not 21 yet, sure. But I remember Mad Bar was like when Mad Bar closed and Red Dog above right there on North Avenue. Yeah, and Urbis Orbis. That's when people said, that's it. Mm-hmm. When Real World came in. The Real World came in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And they set up shop and they did it. And that's when there were protests on North Avenue. Like, you're going to change the neighborhood. Yeah. And I guess they were right, right?
I mean, eventually. You
know, eventually. But I always look to when Mad Bar went. And it went the way of a bar called Cans with a Z.
Oh yeah.
And when Cans is no longer there. Cans was famous because you'd walk by and like Sean Gayle would be hanging out in there. You know, former Bear, mm-hmm. You know, Sean Gayle.
It's funny. I remember seeing Sean Gayle on when the old Rick Bayless restaurant that's on Milwaukee now.
Oh yeah,
it used to be the Circle. Holiday Club there.
Yeah, right.
And I saw Sean Gayle there.
Gayle,
it's so weird.
Sean Gayle loved Wicker Park, man. Like 2000s Wicker Park.
That's so weird.
Yeah. So when Mad Bar went to Cans, that's when I felt like this neighborhood. That's when I was like, I'm out. It's too much. Too many Cans. I have to say that we're talking about it on Friday. My tux worked out. It worked out. It was a strong look. I was worried. I was worried I was going to look like a sophomore going to the junior prom.
You did not.
I did not. I got there and I felt good because I learned a lot about the organization, everything involved. It was a fundraiser. It was an annual benefit from Markland, which is a group that helps people with disabilities, living with disabilities, based in Geneva, Western suburbs. And I was a guest of a friend of mine who, you know, bought a table. And it was great. It was a great experience. But the one thing that I take away from, I don't go to too many black ties, especially downtown. Like, it was very exciting because it was downtown. It was mm-hmm. such a great party. I mean, there's so many people there. It's nuts. Like, when you're talking about fundraisers and people getting together to give money for good causes, this was oh, man, table upon table.
Should have pitched sponsoring you for the air climb while you were there.
I should have. Can I get 1 second on the mic? They had a real deal. Like, they had a microphone set up there that was like, it was a Great Gatsby theme. That was the thing. I didn't know that. So I wish I would have known that. I didn't know that. So luckily, tuxedo worked.
Yeah.
Because I had to, if you're just tuning in and you missed this Friday, I had to rent a tuxedo to go to this. My friend, he essentially forced me to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad he did, because I just kind of was like, I tried to put my tuxedo on that I had from 10 years ago. And it was, I looked kind of like the Hulk. You know, like coming out of that thing. I was like, maybe I just go. That's what I was hoping. It was a superhero theme. If it was like a Marvel superhero theme, then I could have gone as the Hulk and been like, I'm Bruce Banner. My pants don't fit. Right? But that did not happen. So I got a tuxedo and went to the event. The one thing, though, I was really excited because it was down at the Marriott right here on mm-hmm. Michigan Avenue. So I'm like, ooh, it's, you know, we were talking about I got to get a cool photo, which I got, which is the whole thing. But when I got in, I was very excited at the Marriott because a couple of years ago, I was at the Marriott in St. Louis. And I date myself now. It's probably 5 years ago, 6, 7 years ago. And they had a lobby that you could hang out in. And then at 10 o'clock, a band would start, like a straight up R&B band that would play all the hits. Doom, 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 doom,
mm-hmm.
doom, doom. And the dancing started. It was the greatest.
Just for anybody that was walking to the hotel?
I think it was just the hotel, yeah.
Yeah.
And it might have, maybe it wasn't a Ritz, or maybe it wasn't a Marriott, maybe it was a Ritz. It doesn't matter. I got so into it. I got so into the band. The band was awesome. It was like 2 hours of jamming. I was just like, this is the best.
Mm-hmm.
Hotel bands are the best, right? There's nothing better than a hotel band in the lounge. Not unlike Vegas, right? I talked about it when I went to Vegas recently. The band was up there, and it was just like, I don't know how you guys don't have record deals.
Mm-hmm.
The band stuff that you're pulling out at Paris at 10 o'clock on a, you know, in a Vegas casino. So anyway, back to this. I was very excited because I remember I came back to Chicago, and I was like, I need to look this up, and we need to get a crew to go down and watch the lounge show. They got to have one of these in Chicago. It's not just St. Louis, right? So I Googled. They had Google back then. 5 years ago, and I came across it was the Marriott. Downtown Marriott has a band that plays. So then I called, and they said, yeah, they play every Saturday night. And I was like, yes! Right?
All right.
Then I sent out an email saying, hey, Marriott's got a band. If you want to go, no one wanted to go. Fast forward 5 years, right, or whenever it is. And one of the reasons I was excited, they're like, it's at the Marriott downtown. I'm like,
here we go.
It's great. I'm going to go to the event. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to shuffle out with my tuxedo over to the band. Mm-hmm. I walk in there. The concierge is right there like, hi, welcome to the Marriott. I'm like, yes. When does the band start? And they're like, the band? And I'm like, yeah, in your lounge. Where's your lounge? And they're like, I think it was downstairs. And she goes, oh, I had, yeah, we stopped doing that 3 years ago.
Ah.
I was like, what? Why? Why did you stop doing it? That's what I got a little bit surly. Like, I was just like, who stops the awesome R&B band that's playing in the lounge? You know, she didn't have any information. That's what I said. Well, what do you mean? They moved to a different hotel? They do? No, sir, enjoy your stay. I'm like, I'm not staying here. I'm going to the Gatsby party. And then I was going to jam out to some Gap band. And you blew the whole night for me. So, anyway. But I was very excited. It was a good time at the party.
Do they have a band at the party?
No, they had a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good time. Open bar.
It's always nice.
Yeah. The problem for me is that I'm always calculating in my head, and I think this is a shared deal. I rented that tuxedo. Mm-hmm. I talked about how I went in there and they gave it to me for $100.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the website, it said it was $200. I said, nope. I'm paying $100. I'm walking out of here. They gave me $400. And so then in my head, I'm like, well, I am downtown. So every gin and tonic that I have would be somewhere between $15 and $20, right?
Probably, yeah. Right?
So I'm like, how many do I need to drink to break even on this party?
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I gave money for the fundraiser and everything like that. But this just for the, like, I was like, in my head early on, I was like, oh, this has the ability for me to be, to break
come even. Out ahead even.
Right. But the problem is that you're in a tuxedo at a nice function, you know, and every 5 minutes you find yourself going, yeah, can I get another gin and tonic? Like, you can walk up like it's your first one. What do you guys have?
Can't you go to hit the different bartenders? That's what you'd have to do. You can't just go to the same person.
But I did
every time.
The thing where I gave him a $5 bill.
Oh, right at the top.
Yeah,
so
I'm
you
like,
gotta,
hey, this is for all night, guys.
Remember me.
Remember me at the open bar. So regardless, by drink four, I was like, I have not had a night out like that. I was just like, I need to pace myself.
Yeah.
So I don't think I made it. I didn't make it to.
Didn't make it to 100,
whatever the break even was.
Mm-hmm.
I know. That's hey, that's the breaks, as they say. But I was very happy. I didn't lose any of the studs or the cufflinks.
Yeah, it looked, and you know, I know you were worried about getting a rented tux, but yeah. I saw the picture. It looked like it fit.
Yeah, it fit. I realized something special when I was putting it on, is that I was worried because I have a suit at home that was a really nice suit that I got a couple of years back, right? But the problem I have is that it got baggy, or it's a baggy type suit. And so now everybody's really into the thin, sort of thin suit,
mm-hmm.
right? And so when I go, my wife's always like, yeah, you gotta get a new suit. I'm like, no, the baggy was in back in 2004 when I got this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. But then I realize that the tuxedo is the same way. Like, I when I've tried the pants on at the place, they're like, I'm like, oh, that's baggy. It's going to look weird, you know. Luckily, like I said, I could do the joke was, I got to get a new tuxedo. I've had this one for 15 years. But then I realized, and she told me at the place, she's like, no, you're not wearing the pants at the right place. Where's your belly button? I'm like, private. But then, you know, I realized that they said you have to bring the pants up to right below the belly button. Which I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Since when? This is Donald Trump tie time, you know? Like, what's going on here? And so I did that, and the pants fit like that thin kind of look.
Fit.
And I was like, oh.
That's what you do, huh?
Look who's looking like Justin Timberlake right now.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
Wait, all pants go like that?
I don't think all pants, but tuxedo pants.
Oh.
I'm guessing. I don't know. I wasn't paying that much attention. I was trying to get out of there without, like, for some reason, the anxiety of trying on a tux was making me sweat.
I'm always fascinated by, I mean, I don't watch a lot of fashion. I guess the only really fashion shows I watch are ESPN panels. When I see, like, you know, the tie,
yeah.
The tie, the thick, the big ties, or the way, the wacky collars, like, I could never follow.
It's a former outside linebacker, so the suit is just like muscles. And you're like, that suit doesn't fit. Your muscles are too big.
I just don't know what the, like, that's why I like, if I ever get a suit, it's like, I just try to get, like, just a blue classic
or
suit.
Or you just get buff. One of the two, you know, if you can do it. Like, so Lance Briggs, when you see Lance Briggs on Comcast doing the Lance Briggs show, he's like, hey, it's Lance Briggs. I'm like, Lance, your arms are bigger than my legs. Like, you need to calm down. That suit doesn't fit you because you are a beast, right? I don't know if they make – do they make suits for football players like that?
Sure.
I don't know.
Pete mentioned the knots. You know who's got one of the biggest knots on ESPN? Merrill Hodge.
Oh, yeah.
Merrill Hodge's knot is enormous.
Yeah.
It's like a napkin.
Yeah, I don't, like, I can't keep track of, is that fashionable? I saw Keyshawn Johnson was on today, and I saw he had a big one, but it was kind of untied a little bit.
My guess is anyone who's on ESPN is being,
There's a person that costumes them.
Yeah, probably says at the end, like, Merrill Hodge, wardrobe by...
Botany 500.
Yeah.
Is that relevant?
By Napkins R Us, right? See, for me, that's what I wanted to say, wardrobe by Genghis. But I don't think Genghis is around anymore, at least in Chicago. I looked it up today because I put it on Instagram, and I just wanted to make that joke. And I'm like, how do you spell Genghis? And I looked it up, and there are Genghises still in business. They're just not in Chicago. They're like a mini Minnesota company. But hey, wardrobe by Genghis. Welcome back to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, this next topic, we're going to talk about something I wanted to talk about for a while on the program, screen printing. I've always had such a fascination with the artists and the artwork and the art form. Chicago is a great community of artists that work in this field, including my next guest, Ryan Dugan. Dugan has been creating art and printing posters for over a decade. Most of his work centers around creating posters for rock and roll bands like Henry Rollins, Bob Mould, and the OCs, just to name a few. But his work isn't all confined to posters. You can see Ryan's works and designs all over the country in art galleries and on the covers of local papers like the Chicago Reader and New City. Dugan published his book, Dare to be Stupid, which is a collection of his poster art, back in 2015. But tonight, he's in studio with us on the download. Ryan, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So let me ask you, I mean, where as a screen printer, you know, it's such a tremendously specific and creative art form. Mm-hmm. Where do you learn it? As a kid, talk about when you were first introduced to the idea of screen printing.
Well, I originally learned to screen print in high school. I went to Johnsburg High School in Johnsburg, Illinois, and we had a graphics class where we learned basically the applied arts,
right.
Screen printing. We learned to run a small offset press, and we learned how to do vinyl plotting and stuff like that. And then the school put us to work. It was smart. So we would print T-shirts for the basketball team or the football team or whatever. So that was sort of my first introduction to screen printing.
And a lot of people will have that experience. I mean, whether it be, you know, those kind of graphics classes or in some cases, you know, that falls into the woodworking, the ugly arts, as you've called it.
Yeah.
But a lot of schools, will, at least in our generation, had done that. But actually moving forward and deciding to have a career in screen printing, how did that come about?
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't really on purpose at all. Because after I graduated high school and moved to Chicago in 2001, I went to school for advertising copywriting.
Okay.
Not even art or advertising design or anything. I actually thought I was enrolling for advertising design and had enrolled in the copywriting program and just sort of stuck it out. But
you kept saying, this is the intro classes I have to take.
Yeah.
It's all good. Yeah, right.
So by the end of my time at Columbia College studying advertising, I kind of decided that I did not want to work in an ad agency. And I started taking different art classes, and I took a printmaking course. And it sort of reminded me how much I liked doing that back in high school. So then post-college is sort of where I ended up back into screen printing. And that was when a bunch of my friends were in bands and I was in bands and they all needed posters and started asking me to design posters for their shows. And then that was sort of me thinking, like, I used to know how to screen print. I could probably figure this out again.
You know, it's great reading just the process that it takes, at least in the early days when you had the small apartment and you would have to clean out your closet and change up the bathroom. Talk about the experience. If you're actually going to get into screen printing, what it actually takes to do that manually in the space.
Yeah, I mean, screen printing is the cool thing about it is it's one of the only printmaking art forms you can do in a small space like your house because you don't need any giant machinery or toxic chemicals or anything like that. So what I was doing first is I was exposing stuff. Yeah, I was pulling all the clothes out of my closet because it was the only light fast room in the house to dry screens, and then I'd expose it using like lights suspended between two kitchen chairs, and then I'd wash it out in my tub, and then I'd print on a drafting table with no hinges, and then I would wash it out in my tub. And I did this for years at different apartments before I finally got a more legit setup. Sure, yeah. But I definitely ruined a lot of bathtubs. That was a lot of the last day of my lease, cleaning the bathtub for 8 hours straight, hoping that my security deposit would come back.
And it's interesting, too, because screen printing, when you think about that process and the final product, which is a great piece of art, and it might be a band poster, or it might be, you know, you've done so many different things in design, mm-hmm. and we'll get to that. But it's an art form that has been replaced by graphic design. It's been replaced by people doing Photoshop and being able to move the things here and put it together and print and go to the laundromat and say, can I put this poster up? I mean, there has been a lot of strides, but there is this callback to this art form that truly is something that you don't see every day.
Yeah, it's been had a huge resurgence in the last 25 years or so, like a big one coming out of the 90s and then in the early 2000s. But that's the thing is it is like a tactile medium where you can feel the ink on the surface of it. And it's a big, colorful thing if you want it to be. And because in high school, when I would go to see bands a lot, it was a lot of little photocopied flyers. And
right.
they would just be everywhere, little black and white photocopies. And that was sort of like on the beginning of this coming back where you would then go see all these beautiful pieces of art as a advertisement for the show and not just a like quick and dirty little photocopy. And we've definitely come a long way now where the posters are on the merch table for sale.
Yeah, as an artist, you know, who we're talking to Ryan Dugan, he's a screen printer, but he's also an artist here in Chicago. Are there screen printers who brought that back, that concept? And when you talk about the 90s and the bands that I think of, any sort of the alt bands, whether it be Sonic Youth or others, but it seemed like there was a push towards doing that. Are there screen printers who you know in your community that at the forefront of doing that, bringing that back?
Yeah, I mean, Chicago is like the biggest city for this. I mean, we probably have the most screen printers per capita out of any city in America, and this is where the resurgence kind of started. And that was with Steve Walters, who runs Screwball Press. And he taught Jay Ryan how to print. And then Jay Ryan is, of course, like the biggest name who works under the name Bird Machine. And he's been making posters since the 90s. I don't even know how many thousands of posters he's made at this point. But that was kind of the big arc. And then Dan Jetza is another name. Yeah, a lot of mid to late 90s people coming out of there. And then the mm-hmm. 2000s was when it really exploded. And all these people came out of the woodwork, myself included, just all, you know, sort of feeding into this thing. And there was a website called gigposters.com. That was like a huge online meeting place for all these.
So you could go there
artists.
And say, hey, I'm a band. We need a poster. And you could hire an artist and that kind of thing?
No, it was there was that aspect, but it was more like a sort of a Facebook for us, for the screen printers. We had there were forums where you could learn how to build your own exposure unit or how to build a vacuum table. And then there were just, you could post your art and people would comment on it. And, you know, I've met people that I stay in their house when I go to their state now just because of this website. So it was a really cool resource for that. And it was like something that came out of that huge explosion of gig poster art.
Ryan Dugan is my guest. He's the author of Dare to Be Stupid, which is a collection of his unique poster art. He's a screen printer and an artist here in Chicago. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue our conversation with Ryan here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. In studio, artist Ryan Dugan. He's a screen printer. He's also an artist. He does tons of poster art for rock and roll bands, but he also does designs. You can see a lot of his work, or the top 50 art, New City issue. And the Chicago Reader, you're on the best of a couple of those. I'm interested to talk to you about, and this is, it might be a stupid question, but I've always, as sort of someone who's paid attention to it, not really known much about screen printing when it comes to the rock world. Mm-hmm. How much of it is artists doing it pro bono, or, you know, the idea that they love a band and they do a screen print for them even though they don't know anything about it? And how much of is it they get commissioned?
I think it's...
Is that a dumb question?
No,
it feels like a dumb question.
No, it's not a dumb question. I think that there are very few people who do it pro bono and just do it for the love of it. I think that the posters that nobody's paying for are being made by somebody in the band.
Okay, right.
Because
right,
I feel
right,
like right. Most bands, there's at least one person in that band that is somewhat visually inclined and will take on the task of making the poster for that right. band. And then when that band gets big enough or plays a big enough show and thinks they're going to make their money back on the show, they will hire out somebody that, you know, is already doing this professionally to make the poster. And
I think of Sonic Youth as a good example. Like, I'll mm-hmm. see a poster online, or I'll see it maybe at Metro. This is before, you know, it broke up. But the idea that, you know, you'll see it and you go, oh, this is great. And it's so particular to this show at this time.
Yeah.
To screen print this just for here. It's not something that they made in, you know, in Seattle and then just, you know, brought it everywhere because right. they haven't. And I always wondered, is that an homage to the band, or is the band paying for that service?
Yeah, the band is almost always paying for that service, or the venue sometimes will foot the bill of that if they're actually planning on using it for advertising purposes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's usually that a venue or a band will approach me or any artist, and they'll work out the information for the show, and then it's sort of a back and forth on art typically. But I think most of us kind of – you know what you're getting into when you approach – when I get approached, so people know what I'm making. It's usually not a lot of rounds of editing or anything like that.
It's an interesting – I mean, it's such an art form that is attached to another art form when it comes mm-hmm. to music. I mean, it became such a great way to deal with something that has to be done in the idea of promotion and advertising.
Yeah.
And to actually make it an artistic venture as opposed to just here's a flyer that I photocopied.
Yeah.
It's almost – unique to rock and roll, to indie rock in particular, because you think of hip-hop shows and they'll take – just a picture of the rapper, and they'll put it on, they'll lacquer it up on Post No Bills, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
it's not like a shared experience across the board. It's almost like it's very indigenous to rock and roll.
Yeah, it is. There are very few people who have, because we do these events called Flatstock, which is a poster festival. That's where a bunch of us who do this all get together, and the biggest one is during South by Southwest in Austin coming up in March. And that one is where there are hundreds of us, and it's basically like a car show. It's a huge indoor carpeted pipe and drape thing, and you just walk by, and every booth is a different artist. And there is a guy, Bobby Dixon, in Austin, who does hip-hop posters, but he's damn near the only one because it really is like a rock-based thing. There's a lot of metal, and there's a lot of people who specifically work in metal because it's a very, you know, usually a very specific looking poster. But yeah, it's a lot of rock, indie rock, and then of course like punk rock, which is where a lot of this kind of thing came from. Bands like Black Flag in the 80s having Raymond Pettibon making posters and then just wheat pasting them on poles and everything and like advertising it very DIY.
It's such an interesting way to look at art. And for me, it's interesting to see the difference. You know, for you as an artist, you forego the idea of fine art, you know, mm-hmm. and posters fit in the middle somewhere because they're very artistic, but they don't necessarily get classified with that fine art, I guess, genre, if you will. So talk about that, because I thought it was interesting that the dichotomy between the fine arts and what you call the ugly arts.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I sort of consider myself an illustrator more than an artist. I make art, but my day job and my main thing is as an illustrator, and I like to have a starting point. I like working on a poster for a band because I can listen to that band, and then I have a starting point. It's not just pulling it out of thin air.
You can be inspired by their music, right?
Yeah, so, or I already know what their album art looks like, and I know kind of like the general visual aesthetic they have. So I like a starting point. I sort of treat it like, I think like if it was the 40s, 50s or 60s, I would be working for an ad agency or some sort of company just sitting at a desk illustrating things for the backgrounds of other things, or like, you know, the sort of unsung artists of that era where you're just creating for this purpose or working for like a gag gift company. I feel like that would absolutely be my like just illustrating.
That's what you'd be doing.
Illustrating the boxes for like a gag gift novelty company.
That's right. Well, I mean, as an illustrator, where do you find yourself gravitating to when it comes to the art world? I mean, are illustrators tight with painters? Are they tight with musicians? Like, where does illustration fit into the spectrum of artists?
Well, I think now, everybody kind of uses their own medium. I don't think it's sort of based on that anymore. I think it's whether you are creating something specifically for an end result or you're creating something just to create it. So I think whether you paint or whether you're a draftsman or you are creating on a computer, these are things that can still end up a screen print. Like a lot of people will do the whole design on the computer,
right,
and then output it and use this hands-on medium to print it.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, right?
Whereas, like, there's the other complete route where most of my films are made by hand. I paint or draw right onto acetate, and then I make the screens from that and print it by hand. But, yeah, there's a million ways of going about it.
Now, you said you like to start with a starting point. Are you the kind of artist that likes to work with an end point, meaning you're commissioned and this is what you have to do? The reader comes to you and says, do a cover for us. Or are you the kind of artist and illustrator that says, you know what, I'm going to do this and I'm doing this for a creative venture. I want to see where it goes.
I think it's a combination. It's always nice to have a deadline. Like, that's right. A great thing to light a fire under your ass. And I like being approached by the reader, because that's very specific. That's not even just a concert poster. They usually have something in mind. It's this specific issue, or this is a illustration that's accompanying this specific article. So that is what I really like to do, and I wish that was still an industry.
Right.
Like, to be a political cartoonist or to be some sort of a, illustrator on staff at a newspaper is like a dream job that doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And to kind of go farm it out on my own.
A great idea, though. If you had an illustrator instead of a photographer the New Yorker did it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, yeah. It exists in small pockets, but it used to be huge. I mean, editorial cartoonists were on staff at every major newspaper.
Yeah. You've done such great work, and you could see the work in the book, Dare to Be Stupid, the collection of poster art, Ryan Dugan's poster art, but you've also done great designs that you can get on the website, and there's also the commissions for news organizations. What is the end game for you? I mean, is the end game to make money at your art? Would you rather work in one form than another?
I don't know. I kind of like having a mixture of work that I'm sort of thrown. And concert poster art has always probably been my favorite, just because it's, I guess, what I sort of got started in going down this road. But, I like to do all kinds of stuff that gets thrown my way. And I guess the end goal would be that I continue to pay my bills and feed myself every day by making art and drawing.
And trying to have a place where you don't have to clean out the tub when you move.
Yeah.
Right?
Ideally.
Ryan Dugan, it's a pleasure to have you in studio tonight. I'd love to talk more with you at some point, just as, the next project, let us know. You and others in Chicago have made the concert-going experience alone a better experience by being able to look at the walls as you walk in and the old flyers with the black and white scanned from whoever had the office job. I'm glad that that has gone away and your art has replaced it. Ryan Dugan, his book is called Dare to Be Stupid, which is a collection of his poster art. He has done posters for rock and roll bands like Henry Rollins, Bob Mould, the OCs. That's just to name a few. There's hundreds. Also does so much work with local publications like The Reader and New City. Ryan, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. It's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music that Chicago has to offer, right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. We're very happy to have back in studio one of Chicago's brightest up-and-coming stars, Raven Lanae. Raven is a soul R&B singer-songwriter. She was in studio with us last summer talking about her debut album, Moon Shoes. The 18-year-old performer's hitting the road with Chicago poet No Name. They're going to be at Metro this Wednesday and Thursday for two shows. But first, she's here in Studio 435. Good to see you, Raven. Thanks for being
good
here.
Good to see you. Yeah. It's been a while.
It has. It's been a couple months. I remember, I think the last time you were in here, we were talking about, you know, your work, and now you're ready to head out on the road.
Yeah.
Talk about that experience. I mean, this is a big show, and this is one that, you know, is going to take you to a lot of different places. Mm-hmm.
I'm definitely excited because this is my first long tour. I went on another tour with this group called Han for a week. So this is my first long, super, I don't know. It's more extravagant this time. So I'm just more, I don't know. I'm trying to get my mind right before I do it. So
what does that mean? What do you mean, get your mind right?
I don't know. I'm just a super unorganized person. So this is me trying to get my clothes ready, trying to get, you know, everything else ready before I leave because there's no coming back from that point. So, yeah, it'll definitely be an experience, especially because the people I'm going with are my friends and they're people I know. So I think that makes it more... makes it easier, so I'm really excited.
Well, we're going to hear some live music tonight from you and the band that's in studio. Before we do that, I'm interested because last time we talked, I mean, you were the young age of 17. You're now 18. You had a birthday. You're still in high school. So talk about this is something that a lot of professional musicians, this is what they do. They make money by going on tour. For you to still be in high school and to make the move to go on tour, just talk about what goes into that.
Yeah. It's weird. It's weird because I feel like I'm living a double life somehow where I'm still going to school, but then like... at nights and every night I'm playing a show or, you know, I'm doing, I don't know, cool things. So it's really awesome to have my peers support me as well as this, my teachers. But, yeah, they're all just very supportive and that kind of encourages me to do what I want to do, especially because I go to an art school. So that's kind of what they want you to do. They want you to take what you learn there and apply it to the outside world, which is what I'm doing.
How do they get you ready? And how do they get you ready for a life that consists of going on the road?
I think it's cool because all of my music teachers do this for a living. They tour. They're actually out here doing it. So it's one thing to have teachers who don't do it, but it's one thing to have those who do, you know, so they can tell you firsthand what it's like, all the ropes, you know. So I don't know. It's really inspiring. Yeah. So I can ask them anything about that and they'll have an answer. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're heading out. I mean, you have two shows this week at Metro with No Name. Talk about, you said it's, you know, you're lucky to be able to go on the road with your friends. Talk about the community that will be on this tour, your band, No Name, the everyone who's going out on this show.
Mm-hmm. So I'm very good friends with her band. A lot of her bandmates I've known for a while, and I've actually played with her music director, Kenya, who's also amazing. She's an amazing singer, songwriter, musician altogether. So I don't know. I think it'll just be super fun that way. You know, I get to travel with my friends. So I'm really excited.
So for this show, I mean, what are you planning to do? I mean, what we see at Metro is also what we'll see on stage. I mean, did you have to sort of really put in work to get that sort of that full set on? I mean, this is a full show. I mean, I don't know how much you have in terms of minutes that you get to perform. But I mean, talk about the idea of putting a set list together and getting ready to go out on the road.
I definitely had to groom my set that I already had. So we're still in the process of doing that. But yeah, I think this time around, I'm just more in tune with my sound and the vibe I want to give, you know, to the audience. So me and my music director, Sam, have been talking about who do I want to be as an artist and what do I want to leave the audience with when I leave. So I think I've been more in tune with myself in that way.
Talking with Sam about it, I mean, how much of that have you thought about in your young career? Has it just been sort of making songs and doing, I mean, at what point do you have to start thinking about what all professional musicians have to do, which is just find that connection. What are you selling?
Mm-hmm. I think it started recently, actually, because for a while I was just, you know, doing me. But now it's like, okay, Raven Lanae is a brand, not just a person anymore. So I have to switch mindsets now and apply myself that way. So it's definitely a different world, you know. I have to think twice about things or three times or just, you know, reevaluate myself as an artist. So It's really interesting.
All right, well, we're going to hear some music, and then we'll talk about the music, because I want to talk, you know, last time we talked about, you know, how, what are your inspirations and the sort of the approach you have creatively to your music. And mm-hmm. I want to hear about how that's changed and how that's evolved, even in the short time that, you know, since the last time you were in studio. Raven Lene in studio tonight with her band. They are here in Studio 435. She's got a show at Metro on Wednesday and Thursday. Before they head out on the big tour with Chicago poet No Name. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we will get some live music in Studio 435 with Raven Lene. Stay with us. Welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's The Download. It's Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music that Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, right in downtown Chicago. In studio with us tonight, very happy to have her back, Raven Lene. She's a soul R&B singer-songwriter. She was in studio with us this past summer. We talked about her debut album, Moonshoes. The 18-year-old performer's hitting the road with Chicago poet No Name. They're going to be at Metro this Wednesday and Thursday for a show, but she's here at Studio 435 with her band. Austin Ferris is on guitar, Sam Johnson on drums, Eric Hunter on the bass, and Christopher Hallam on the keys. Here is the track Blossom Deary. Take it away, guys.
From you, vibrations are strumming the emptiness of the room, melting all your words in my, tell me all them things that I am. I wish that I could speak your perfect language. I wish that we could travel to those places where we're faceless and we're nameless. Don't you crave this? I can feel the atmosphere unfolding. Just tell me if your pretty heart's worth holding. 'Cause I can feel the atmosphere unfolding. Just tell me if your pretty heart's. I know you wanna hear me toned on at Blossom Deary. And I try to speak to you in tongues, but you never hit to sing me right. And I never seem to lose a run when we're following your stars at night. You say your lungs are never breathing right. Your mother's never eaten right. She said she never really won her fight. She's handing me her toys to light you up. Your fears and tribulations, they are formula to a painting. They are formula to a painting of us. As I peer across the nation, all your stars get to formation. They are more than your creation. They're love. Of our hearts are syncopated, vindicated, leave our doubts asleep right here. Ooh, 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 ooh. Yeah. I wish that I could speak the perfect language. I wish that we could travel to those places that we're faceless, that we're nameless. Don't you crave this? I can feel the atmosphere unfolding. Just tell me if your pretty heart's worth holding. 'Cause I can feel the atmosphere unfolding. Just tell me if your pretty heart's, your pretty heart's, your pretty heart's. 'Cause I can feel the atmosphere. Atmosphere is unfolding, it's unfolding. Can y'all feel the atmosphere? Can y'all feel the atmosphere? I can feel the atmosphere. fear is unfolding, unfolding. Say, ooh. Say, ooh. Say, ooh. Say, ooh.
There you go. That's Studio 435 for you right there. Raven Lene in studio with her band Austin Ferris, Sam Johnson, Eric Hunter, and Christopher Hallam. The track was Blossom Deary. She's going to be at the Metro on Wednesday and Thursday opening up for No Name. It's great. I mean, it's amazing. That was an amazing performance.
Thank you
for that.
Thank you.
And we're going to hear more this hour. You know, last time we talked, I mean, you talked about just how your music kind of evolves. For you, talk about... You know, not only as a songwriter, we'll get into that, but mm-hmm. just as someone who's, I mean, you know, you're a high school senior.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of your voice and how it's evolving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the craft. Mm-hmm. Talk about how you what you're doing to essentially grow into your voice.
Mm-hmm. I think it's always interesting to listen to my old music, not even listening to the lyrics, but my voice and how it has matured over, you know, the span over a couple months mm-hmm. or a couple years. And I don't know. It's just you have to work. Like people always ask me, how does that happen? The voice is a muscle just like anything else. You have to exercise it as such. So I'm always amazed at how you can develop that way in such a short amount of time when you're working it. But yeah. And also with my songwriting now, I try to cater to that part of my voice. So ranging from the lowest part of my voice to the highest to make myself work harder. When writing,
do you find yourself, you know, being able to work on parts of your voice that you didn't know you had before? Like, I mean, are you finding different registers and different ways that you sing that you're like, this is new and you're going with it and you're writing towards it?
Definitely. You know, I don't even do it on purpose, but most of the time when I write, it's in the morning. You know, in the morning, you can sing super low. You're just so I always write super low in the morning. Then I go to my studio session like later on. I'm like, why did I write this low? But I force myself to get there, you know, because I can obviously do it, you know. It's just putting it in my mind that I can do it, you know. So I don't know, I try to stretch it that way.
Talk about the experience of playing with this live band. You know, for you, I mean, you've written a lot of stuff and you've been able to put it together, but mm-hmm. the idea of going on a tour and playing with the guys you got behind you,
mm-hmm. man, it's one thing to record to a song and not having live instruments, but when you bring it to life on stage, it just feels much warmer and real. So I always like playing with them because I don't know, we have a sense of where we want to go with the songs and how we want to bring beauty to it or bring it to life. And I think we do a pretty good job at that. So yeah, I enjoy
performing.
How much does it take?
I mean, are you guys together? What does it take weekly for you guys to be able to put a set together to go out on the road?
It takes a lot of late nights. Literally, after we leave here, we're going to rehearsal.
Eric's rubbing his eyes over here.
After we leave here, we're going to rehearsal. So it takes dedication and lack of sleep. You just have to get over it.
That's good. Raven Lene in studio with us tonight, Studio 435. She is heading out on tour. She got a show at Metro this Wednesday and Thursday. All right, so let's get a track in before the news. What else do you got? What are you going to play here?
Let's do Everything Above.
Everything Above?
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound good, guys? You guys ready on that? Good. Everything Above, Austin Ferris, Sam Johnson, Eric Hunter, Christopher Hallam, the band with Raven Lene. They are playing, opening up for No Name on tour, but they're also going to be playing at Metro this Wednesday and Thursday. The album, the debut album we talked about this summer is Moon Shoes. Here is Raven Lene.
Seen a night like this? If you things exist. How do you know where you are going when all them signs are showing that it's true? We're not the only ones. Says everything above, it's done. If you thought that we were not the only ones, it's done. In this moment, there's no questions or no lessons, it's done. If you thought that we were not the only ones, it's done. In this moment, there's no questions, no lessons, it's talks about where we came from. I don't know what to choose. Well, I'd rather not talk about it. I'd rather not, cause they can tell me this and that, and riff and raff, and they don't know I do. But I say blah, 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 blah. But in this moment, there's no pull or tug. In this moment, but in this moment, there's no pull or tug. In this moment, I say everything above. If you thought that we were not the only ones, it's done. In this moment, there's no questions, no lessons, it's done. If you thought that we were not the only ones, it's done, it's done, it's done, it's done, it's done.
I love it. Studio 435, Raven Lene and her band in studio tonight. The 18-year-old performer hitting the road with poet No Name. She's going to be at Metro this Wednesday and Thursday night. Her band, Austin Ferris on guitar, Sam Johnson on the drums, Eric Hunter on the bass, and Christopher Hallam on the keys. Wow, much, much more. We'll get another song out of you guys after the news here. It's tremendous, tremendous stuff.
Thank you.
And I want to talk, you know, when we come back, let's talk about the community as well. Because mm-hmm. there's so many great artists, R&B soul artists, who also are doing hip-hop work in mm-hmm. this town. I mean, it is just blowing up, and you're a big part of that. So we'll talk more with Raven Lene about her music, and we'll hear some more here on Studio 435. Thank you, Rob. Studio 435 here on 720 WGN. Tonight, live music from Raven Lene. The soul R&B singer is going out on tour with the Chicago poet No Name. They're going to be at Metro this Wednesday and Thursday. Where does that, is that the kickoff for the tour?
It is the kickoff.
Kickoff.
It is.
Wow,
you have to start it right.
You have to start in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. Where do you guys go next?
Oh, where are we going? Is it Milwaukee?
You're just hitting the...
Madison.
So is the idea just pack up the van and go? Is that kind of thing? Are you at the are you at the point now where you're just like, I'll fly and the band can drive?
Actually, okay. So no. For the closer states, I'm flying. I mean, yeah. I'm driving. But then for the farther yeah. ones, I'm definitely flying.
You're not ready for that.
Yeah, I wish I could just snap and be there, but that's not a thing yet.
You got to get that rock and roll. This is your first big tour. You got to get that rock and roll feel. You got
to
get
right, you're right.
A broken down
experience.
Van. Yeah.
Exactly.
Raven Lene is here with her band. Austin Ferris, Sam Johnson, Eric Hunter, Christopher Hallam are in studio. I keep mentioning the album Moon Shoes,
mm-hmm.
and we talked about that. What's the where are you at with music? I mean, are you recording? Are you thinking about new music? Because you had done Moon Shoes off of the EP, made it the full length.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing now?
Now I'm working on another short project called Midnight Moonlight. It's to be released sometime this month. Tentatively. I go back and forth with myself a lot. So I think it's this month, though. Yeah, I'm really excited about new music. I think everyone else is, too. I'm just trying to polish everything up beforehand.
For you, I mean, because you've done your own material.
Mm-hmm.
You've also guested, you know, mm-hmm. in the way that you'll feature on stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about that. I mean, you have found yourself in a position where you can be both a sort of soul singer who does your own tour, and then also be able to collaborate with the hip hop community here in Chicago.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Talk about the idea of collaborating with music that isn't necessarily the music that you're producing.
I think it's super important for you not to box yourself in and say, oh, I only do soul music and I would never, you know, because there's so many opportunities out there and so many great artists that I would never want to limit myself that way. And I don't know. I learn from them all the time, you know, even if it's not my taste of music, I'm still learning from them. I'm looking at their technique. I'm looking at their cadences, you know, all of that I keep in mind and I note. So I think it's an experience. Whenever I work with someone else, I learn something and I take away from it.
Chicago has a tremendous hip hop community.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see maybe on a national stage. We'll see next week with the Grammys, you know, and Chance
I know,
the Rapper. But
it's crazy.
Even beyond that, I mean, you've seen so much with the Save Money Crew and the hip hop MCs that are just getting national attention.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a groundswell of artists like yourself that are doing things. A lot of women singers in Chicago that are creating a name for in this sort of, I guess, a genre that you would call soul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think right off the bat of Jamila Woods mm-hmm. and Erica Allen Kane. Like, there just seems to be a real sort of groundswell. Do you feel that?
I do feel it, especially in the lady community. I think that a lot of us, we stand together in Chicago, and it's really funny because we have this, like, unspoken sisterhood because it's only a couple of us, so we try to stay tight together, you know, and we definitely support you. We go to each other's shows, we even hop on each other's songs. So I think it's really important, and I'm so glad you brought that up. I made a tweet the other day saying, like, hey, us girls are doing it too, you know, like mm-hmm. you know yeah. So
no, but I mean, it is something, because it, you know, I'm trying to think, because we had on the show, Jeremiah came on, mm-hmm. which was awesome. And I think about even R. Kelly before that. I mean, there's a, and you go even back into the 60s with the Impressions and band soul has been an art form, a genre in Chicago that is almost unprecedented. I mean, you can get a lot out of Philadelphia and New York and California as well, but it feels like Chicago, there is a connection mm-hmm. to this kind of music in this town.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that?
I definitely agree. I think Chicago has formed its own sound. I think if I were to hear something and I was tested on where it's from, I would know off the bat, oh, that's Chicago. Just because I feel like we've developed, you know, that sense of character and, yeah, culture.
To be such a young artist, I mean, do you pay attention to the people who came before you? I mean, are you thinking about the artists, the soul artists that were here decades before you?
Yeah, I take a lot of inspiration. I watch a lot of interviews. I watch a lot of old shows. But I try to stay away from pulling too much. I take it with a grain of salt because I am my own person at the end of the day. And I don't know. I would much rather take inspiration from things that don't necessarily, have character or life and combine it to make a story or to make a painting, you know, with words. Mm-hmm. So whether it's the sky or sun or a flower, I like to say things like that that can be perceived in any way. So me taking something from it would not be copying or, you know,
you're inspired by it.
You're inspired by it. So yeah, that's me.
You know, we're talking with Raven Lanay here in Studio 435. We're going to get one last track from these guys right after the break here. You know, it's interesting because we talked about Chicago and we talk about its impact. You know, you, as you talked about earlier, and even this hour, talk about having to go from artist to brand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you get, it's just fun to even today when I've already interviewed you. So I was mm-hmm. like, okay, well, I got to listen to this. I gotta listen to stuff again. Mm-hmm. And I went and I Googled around and I was like, God, from the promo shots to the interviews to whatever. I mean, there's definitely another side of this business. It's not just the music.
Yes.
It's, It's what you have to do to promote the music, which yes. you're doing right now. Talk about that. Talk about like being prepared to sort of be a spokesperson for yourself.
Mm-hmm. My manager told me that making music is like 20% of it, and the rest of it is all business, you know. And that's never been so true. Now I'm seeing that, you know. It's all business, you know? So me making music is just a small percentage of it. And I'm starting to realize that, and I'm starting to get a grasp of that side of it, you know? I think it's important for me to know what's going on and for me to be hands-on with that part of it as well. Because I feel like it all works together. If the business is off, the music is off. If the music is off, the business is off.
You said you were, you know, you go to an arts high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, is that part of the curriculum there, where they recognize that you're getting you ready for a professional career mm-hmm. in the arts? I mean, is some of it about sort of dealing with some of the things that are outside of the actual mm-hmm. art form?
My junior year of high school, I took a class called Professional Development, which focused solely on that. Being an artist, touring, you know, managing your money, managing yourself. So I'm really happy because around that time is when stuff started to pick up for me. So I'm reading this stuff like, okay, how can I apply this to myself? And it just all really made sense. And it kind of put my head on my own shoulders about my brand and my business.
Raven Lynae is in studio with us tonight. Her band is here as well. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll get one last live track here for Studio 435 with Raven Lynae. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Studio 435. We're wrapping up our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago's got to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. It's nice out tonight, too. There's actually people on the street for once, and they're going to treat tonight. Raven Lynae, the soul singer-songwriter, is in studio talking about her show that she's got at Metro this Wednesday and Thursday. She's opening up for the poet No Name, Chicago poet No Name. In studio with her band, Austin Ferris playing guitar, Sam Johnson on drums, Eric Hunter on bass, Christopher Hallam on keys. Here is the final track tonight called Free Room. Take it away, guys.
Shake your thighs in a room full of fond of hope and tainted skies. The eyes you think you shake your thighs in a room full of fond of hope and tainted skies. I run out of stuff, so I don't know what to do. Things you thought you knew, but you don't know me anymore, anymore, anymore. Oh, oh, oh. You don't know me anymore, anymore, anymore. I run until I find my lungs. I thought you had a clue. You are. Till you find the things and me you thought you knew, but I don't know you. So there's zero judgment, there's a free room. You don't know me anymore, anymore, anymore. Oh, oh, oh. You don't know me anymore, anymore, anymore. Know me anymore, anymore, anymore. You think you run away, you think you're getting away, away. You think you run away, you think you're getting away, away. You think you're running away, you think you're going, 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 going.
Hey, yeah. Give it up, Chicago. Yes, Studio 435, Raven Lene. You can check out her album, Moon Shoes, which is everywhere you can find on SoundCloud, also streaming sites. The 18-year-old performer is hitting the road. She's going to be performing with Chicago's No Name. They're going to be at Metro to kick off the tour Wednesday and Thursday. Also going to be with the band Austin Ferris, Sam Johnson, Eric Hunter, and Christopher Hallam. What a great performance. I can't thank enough.
Thank you.
Great to see you, and congrats on all your success. And you got to continue to come back here.
I know, right? Let's make this a thing.
I love it. I am blown away by your talent, man. You are an amazing talent. Chicago's lucky to have you.
Thank
Raven
you.
Lene and the band in studio tonight. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Pete, I haven't checked. Is the filibuster still going on? The Betsy DeVos filibuster for the education section are going all night. Is anyone reading Dr. Seuss yet? If I were them, and this is the senators in D.C., the Democratic senators are protesting the confirmation hearings and vote tomorrow for education secretary nominee Betsy DeVos. They're stalling with the filibuster tactics. But if I were them, I would just do homework from like sixth grade. Like just read all the Common Core questions. A train going 90 miles per hour this way, arrives at the same time in Philadelphia, that kind of thing. It'll be interesting to see if that works, because there's one vote shy, and very interesting that it'll be the first time. I think it's unprecedented. I think it's never been done before that for confirmation. The sitting president of the Senate, who is the vice president, will cast the deciding vote. Right now, they're actually tied. And Mike Pence, when there's a tie, it goes to the president of the Senate, and he casts his vote, and he would be casting for Betsy DeVos, of course. So it is interesting that they are trying right now desperately to get one Republican senator to cross over and deny her the confirmation. But I just don't see that happening. Maybe, someone gets tired and they get delirious and they're like, all right, I voted. They hit the wrong, vote for the wrong yes or no. On the hit the wrong button. I'm so sorry. Jonah from Veep. He doesn't show up. It's all that. So, yeah. So we'll see if that happens. There's a really interesting article in the Tribune today that features Rahm Emanuel. It's a speech he did at Stanford. I think he did it, over the weekend, some sort of graduation or commencement. I don't know what the actual, speaking to Innovator or something like that. But he talked about his party, the Democratic Party, and their obsession with needing to be right over winning. Meaning even in their lose, they want to be right. Even if they lost this election to Donald Trump, they want to be right. And he said it's all about winning. And you have to do what it takes to win, because if you win, then you're in control of public policy. And so he said one of the Rahm Emanuel, for whatever it's worth, before he was mayor of Chicago, was the architect of a lot of at least the big one. I forgot what year it was, but when he took the Congress back from George W. Bush and the Republicans, he's sort of the insurgent, if you will, for Democrats. And he talks about, you read this article, it's very interesting, about like look for divisions and exploit those divisions. He said if they're talking about Russia and John McCain and Lindsey Graham are on one side and Donald Trump's on the other, exploit that division. And I think I was thinking about that as it applies to Betsy DeVos, because a couple of Republican senators have crossed over to make this closer than it should be. And you wonder if that is why on this nomination you're seeing Democrats filibuster and try to grab as much attention as possible, because there has been divisions. If it was a straight ahead, like you saw it on Rex Tillerson, who's somewhat controversial, you'll see it with the ones that are coming up here, including Jeff Sessions for Attorney General. If it goes along party lines, they're not going to filibuster. But the idea that there's a little crack in the foundation, that senators on the Republican side of the aisle don't necessarily agree and have flipped to the Democratic side, that's what Rahm Emanuel is talking about. That's why they're going to make us think about it right now.
Let me ask you this, Justin. Do you think that DeVos could be the political red meat served up by the Republicans in order to get Gorsuch nominated as a Supreme Court justice?
It's a great question. Behind that might be what's happening right here.
Because you have that quid pro quo going on all the time.
There's a ton of negotiations that go behind closed doors. And, you know, I watched that PBS documentary that was The Divided Nation. And that's all they did for the last 8 years with Obama, is just go behind closed doors and negotiate and make bargains. That's a great point. If they voted along party lines at this point, wouldn't Gorsuch get in? Like, he would, there would be no way to stop it unless Democrats do exactly what they're doing here, just filibuster and kind of complain and whine and for hours on end.
Well, let me point out the abundantly obvious. I think they'd be willing to sacrifice an education secretary to get their guy in the Supreme Court.
It begs the question of whether or not the Republicans are united enough with Trump and the senators to sort of be one when it comes to negotiations. Because Donald Trump doesn't want anyone to lose, right? He's not looking for anyone to be sacrificed. Well, Republicans have played this game for years in D.C. and they know it doesn't matter. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't know, because Trump even though he's a grand businessman, it doesn't seem like he likes to bargain, especially when it's his ego on the line. But I don't know. That's a great point, though. I never thought about that. Or even, you know, stop Democrats from doing this to every pick. You know, like, why not? What stops them from doing it with Jeff Sessions or doing it with Pruitt, right? The EPH, there's a lot of protests around him. So it's going to be interesting. So
it's going to be fun to follow.
Tomorrow night, we have Northwestern basketball. Big game against the Illini. They got to get some wins. They got to win these. And they have to still get a win between the games with Maryland and Wisconsin coming up. I'd like to see them take one of those so they don't end up with a really low seed in the tournament if, you know, things go south after that loss to Purdue the other night.
They better crush U of I.
Yeah, they just need to put some wins in the win category, get up over 20 wins, you know, so we're not sweating this thing out bubble-wise at the end here. Just don't pull an Atlanta Falcons. That's what it's going to be from here on out. Don't pull an Atlanta Falcons. So, we'll be on after the game. I believe the game ends probably around 9, 9:30, and so we'll be on after that, and we'll play the worst tomorrow night here on The Download.